Welcome to Bladder and Renal Cell Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Matthew Galsky from the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and to begin, I asked him to present a patient from his practice with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer.
So this is a 52-year-old man who initially presented with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, and non-muscle invasive bladder cancer is commonly treated. He received treatment with BCG. And after receiving treatment with BCG, he was monitored and ultimately developed abdominal pain a couple years after his initial diagnosis, and on imaging was found to have diffuse adenopathy, and he underwent a biopsy of those enlarged lymph nodes, ultimately revealing metastatic disease, metastatic urothelial cancer. Not the most common scenario to present with a non-muscle invasive disease and really go directly to metastatic disease, but something that we do see from time to time.
Did they go back and look in his bladder?
They did, and he did have evidence of disease in the bladder at that time.
I was going to ask you before, what fraction of patients present for the first time at first diagnosis with metastatic disease, and how do you manage them?
So it's about 5% if you look at SEER data, and those patients probably have a little bit more aggressive disease in terms of its behavior. They're probably overrepresented on clinical trials for a number of reasons, but when you look at the breakdown of patients who've had prior definitive treatment of their primary tumor on clinical trials, it's usually not this, 95% that you would expect based on SEER data. In fact, we see that probably about 20 to 30% of patients, depending on the trial, have not had definitive treatment to their primary tumor in the past. Those patients, we really don't treat differently in terms of the regimens that we use, but anecdotally, it does seem to be a little bit more of an aggressive course.
How do you deal with the primary in that situation? If it's asymptomatic, use systemic therapy. What do you do if they are having local symptoms?
So if they're not having local symptoms, certainly we tend not to do a whole lot about the tumor in the bladder. If they're having local symptoms, primarily bleeding, then it depends how bothersome the bleeding is. Oftentimes, a good transurethral resection of bladder tumor, TURBT, is sufficient to control bleeding without having to resort to something like radiation, which might interfere with or delay the initiation of systemic treatment.
Now, when you do use systemic therapy, whether it's chemotherapy or immunotherapy, do you see responses in the primary?
We do, and if there are symptoms related to the primary, such as pain, but not something like intractable bleeding, then usually there is sufficient likelihood of response with these treatments that patients will experience some alleviation of those symptoms.
So this patient was one of those who did develop progressive disease. Incidentally, being age 52, what's the age distribution of muscle invasive bladder cancer?
The median age of diagnosis is around 73 in the United States, and so certainly he is on the young side of that age distribution.
What was his renal function? He had this extensive adenopathy, retroperitoneal adenopathy. Any renal obstruction or renal dysfunction?
He didn't have any renal dysfunction, really had intact kidney function.
And his disease was confined to the nodes?
That's right. And subsequently, he was found to have an adrenal mass as well.
So how was he managed then?
So he was managed initially with what could be considered standard treatment. He received dose-dense MVAC. We more commonly use in the perioperative setting these days, although in a young patient with really lymph node only or predominantly lymph node metastatic disease, it's a regimen that's not unreasonable. He received that treatment and, like a large proportion of patients, had a good response with an objective response to treatment.
How would you have approached the same situation if he'd been 75, 80, or 85?
In an older patient with a similar distribution of disease, really, I look at two things: their functional status and their kidney function. There are patients within that age range who I would consider an aggressive regimen like this, like dose-dense MVAC, although the majority of patients realistically don't receive that treatment. And more commonly these days, if I feel like I can administer a cisplatin-based regimen, it's going to be split-dose gemcitabine and cisplatin. What I mean by that is giving gemcitabine on days 1 and 8 at 1,000 milligrams per meter squared, and then cisplatin at 35 milligrams per meter squared on days 1 and 8, and that treatment's recycled every 21 days. this specific regimen has been studied prospectively in a small phase 2 study in bladder cancer, but really showed results that were pretty comparable to what's achieved with the more standard dose and schedule. And this trial enrolled patients with a creatinine clearance of 40 and above and was really shown to be pretty safe in patients with borderline kidney function.
So what was the next step in this man's course?
So he had a good response to treatment, and really what we do as standard of care in patients with metastatic urothelial cancer after receiving 6 cycles of treatment, provided that they haven't had disease progression and they're tolerating treatment relatively well, we stop treatment and we wait. And so that's what happened. He completed treatment and then went on surveillance scans. And typically we do scans every 3 months in that setting. And he had a response to first-line treatment that lasted fairly long, about a year, and then subsequently developed disease progression in the adrenal gland, in the lungs, and progressive lymphadenopathy.
So nowadays, I imagine he would have gotten a checkpoint inhibitor at that point, but he got more chemotherapy.
That's right. He got additional chemotherapy using drugs that are commonly administered in this setting before the immune checkpoint blockade era, and he received treatment with gemcitabine, now commonly used in the first-line setting, although he had not received the treatment before, and then treatment with a taxane with docetaxel, and unfortunately didn't really have good responses to those regimens.
So at that point, he actually did get a checkpoint inhibitor, I see. What happened?
So he was treated with atezolizumab, and by the time he initiated that treatment, really was having more of a burden related to symptoms, was having pain, was having fatigue, some decrease in appetite, and initiated treatment. And within about 2 cycles, clinically, it was clear that he was feeling better. His pain decreased, his energy level increased, he was more active. And he continued on treatment. And after cycle 6, his initial restaging evaluation after starting treatment, there was already some reduction in the size of tumor. But interestingly, over the next year, his areas of measurable disease continued to decrease slowly. A very interesting response kinetics, and really not what we're used to seeing with cytotoxic chemotherapy.
And so what's his current situation?
He received his 40th cycle of treatment this week.
Wow. So he's been on treatment for more than 2 years.
He's been on treatment for more than 2 years, tolerated it really quite well. He's developed a rash, which has been managed at times with topical steroids. Other times, he doesn't require any management of the rash. And really, that's been his major adverse event.
Can you talk a little bit more about where exactly he had the rash? And I hear a lot about rashes with checkpoint inhibitors as being not really a big deal, but very common. Is that the case?
That's been my anecdotal experience as well. His rash was on the face, erythema sort of in a distribution on his cheeks, and he also had some scattered erythema on his arms and legs as well, mild itching. And that's been characteristic of other patients that I've seen as well. Not necessarily the face, but this mild erythema, mild itching that occurs on the body and the arms and legs.
Any sort of preemptive dermatologic measures you take in these patients?
Given that the rash has not been bothersome for the majority of patients that I've treated, and that even when it does develop, we oftentimes don't treat it, and if anything, use a topical steroid, we haven't been pursuing preemptive management.
This might be a good time to sort of take a step back and talk about the data that we have on checkpoint inhibitors. Obviously, atezolizumab now is approved in bladder cancer. Maybe we can start out with that in terms of, well, first, in the mechanism of action, because it's actually anti-PD-L1.
That's correct.
As opposed to PD-1. First of all, what does that mean to you?
So atezolizumab is an anti-PD-L1 antibody. Of course, I look at PD-L1 and PD-1 blockade as really blocking 2 components of the same interaction. Really, if you imagine 2 people shaking hands, you're blocking one arm or the other. And so from a mechanistic standpoint, I'm not sure that there's the anticipation of so much in the way of difference, with the exception of being the potential importance of other ligands binding to PD-1, such as PD-L2. And of course, if that is important, then blocking PD-L1 allows the PD-L2, PD-1 interaction to remain intact, and one could postulate beneficial effects from that or potential detrimental effects, and that's really where the clinical data has to sort that out.
And just to be clear, if I understand it correctly, anti-PD-L1 binds with the PD-L1 ligand, but anti-PD-1 binds the receptor, which, as you said, would be involved with both PD-1 and PD-2?
That's right, with both PD-L1 and PD-L2.
And I've heard it said that there's a thinking that maybe there would be less toxicity with anti-PD-L1, specifically pulmonary toxicity. I don't know if that actually has played out.
So I think that certainly was postulated initially as these trials were getting up and running. And if you look at the data, it really doesn't provide a strong signal in support of that.
So what are the clinical research data right now with atezolizumab? And maybe you can compare them to the data we have available for pembrolizumab, nivolumab, the other PD-1 antibodies, as well as others that are in development, durvalumab, for example.
So atezolizumab has been explored in a large phase 2 study. And the phase 2 study, called the IMvigor study, enrolled two cohorts of patients. One cohort of patients had received prior cisplatin-based chemotherapy and then had disease progression. And the other cohort of patients were patients who were chemotherapy naive but considered cisplatin ineligible. The cohort that received treatment for the cisplatin refractory setting or the cisplatin resistant setting was the first data that was reported and published in The Lancet. And that study showed that there was a response rate to treatment in that setting of about 15%. Certainly not an incredibly robust response rate, but importantly, the responses in the majority of patients on this study were not unlike what I described with this patient, really quite durable responses. And so while the response proportion is somewhat low, one, it's really as good or better than anything we've had in the past in this situation. Two, the responses are really quite durable, which is really unlike anything we've seen in this setting. And three, the treatment is in general quite well tolerated, which differs from standard chemotherapy.
Of course, that's a theme that we've heard across oncology. And one of the related issues is whether or not it can ever be stopped. Even in this man, I wonder if you're thinking about that.
Yeah, so that's a discussion that we have not uncommonly. And in this patient, it's been a little bit less of a dilemma, although still somewhat of a dilemma, but a little bit less because he still has measurable disease, even though he's had this really prolonged response. I do have other patients who've had complete responses who are out about 2 years for whom this is really more of a major issue in terms of what do we do now. And patients, not surprisingly, are hesitant to stop treatment, as am I, to be honest.
Before we get into the other data, I'm just kind of curious. You mentioned that the trial allowed people without prior chemotherapy, if they were chemotherapy or I guess cisplatinum ineligible. Right now, will the indication cover first-line therapy in a patient who has, for example, poor renal function and can't get, say, cisplatinum?
So the current indication for atezolizumab is for patients who've had prior platinum-based chemotherapy and have had disease progression. The data in the first-line setting for cisplatin-ineligible patients, as I mentioned, was reported later. That study took a little bit longer to mature. And those data are in press right now. In that cohort, in the first-line setting, the response rate is more in the 24% range. That response rate is lower than what we see with standard chemotherapy with something like gemcitabine and carboplatin. But again, the responses are quite durable. And when you look at the survival of those patients compared to historical controls, it does appear that the needle might be moved with this treatment. And so it's certainly compelling data, but there's no labeled indication in this setting yet. I say yet because there is certainly an interest in the community to see this data lead to the ability to change practice. I have used this treatment for patients who are cisplatin ineligible for whom I think that chemotherapy would offer undue risk or, frankly, in patients who've refused chemotherapy.
So you've been able to get it paid for?
Yes.
Interesting. I mean, you also have the concept of, you know, a less toxic therapy. I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, say, renal cell and melanoma with the idea of even if you have a therapy that might have a higher response rate, if they're asymptomatic and they could wait, you know, take a shot at launching them into a long-term remission. Do you think that's the way it's going to play out as time moves on?
I think that's a strategy that probably will be embraced. And that's a strategy that patients who are, quote unquote, refusing chemotherapy, I think that's really in the back of many of their minds. They want to give this a shot. And if it doesn't work, then maybe they will consider taking something that might be more burdensome to their quality of life.
Can you talk a little bit about the other data sets we have for other checkpoint inhibitors, maybe starting out with nivolumab?
Nivolumab has been studied in a large phase 2 study. This study enrolled patients similar to the atezolizumab dataset, patients who had received platinum-based chemotherapy and then subsequently had disease progression. And the response rate to treatment in that study was 19.6%. The responses were quite durable, again, consistent across PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors and consistent across indications. And the safety profile was really quite similar as well.
And pembrolizumab, I know there was some data presented recently.
So pembrolizumab, the only data we had for pembrolizumab until just a few weeks ago was an expansion cohort of a phase 1 study, which was really quite small. And that showed promising activity with pembrolizumab in patients who had received prior chemotherapy. And that was one of the data sets that really led to enthusiasm for this approach in metastatic urothelial cancer. So based on that data, a phase 3 randomized study was initiated. And this study compared pembrolizumab with standard of care chemotherapy. And that standard of care chemotherapy could be a taxane, or in countries where vinflunine was available, patients could receive vinflunine. We haven't seen the full published results of this study yet, but what we do know from the presentation is that the likelihood of achieving an objective response to treatment was significantly higher in patients who received pembrolizumab. The overall survival was better in patients who received pembrolizumab, and this included the subset of patients who had increased PD-L1 expression. In addition, looking at the side effect profile, pembrolizumab appeared to be much better tolerated than standard chemotherapy.
I guess the other checkpoint here we've heard about is another anti-PD-L1 agent, durvalumab. What do we know about that?
So we have data from a fairly large experience with durvalumab in patients with, again, chemotherapy pretreated metastatic urothelial cancer. And if you look at that data set and compare it to the other data sets, the response rate seemed to be a bit higher. However, that has to be interpreted with caution for a couple of reasons. One, because the sample size is still smaller than the sample sizes that we have with these other drugs, and so the confidence intervals are wide. And the other issue is that patients were initially selected based on PD-L1 expression, and then all comers were allowed. And so it's a little bit of a mixed population and might have been enriched a little bit for response.
Globally, when we look at all these trials and strategies, what do we know about predictors of benefit or predictors of response, and particularly PD-L1 assays?
So the PD-L1 data is really across the board, like it is in many cancers. For some trials, like the atezolizumab data in the chemotherapy-resistant population, you do appear to enrich the likelihood of response to treatment by using an assay testing for PD-L1 expression. Similarly, with the nivolumab data, a similar finding. However, in both of those data sets, even for patients with no PD-L1 expression, the response rates are still as good to better than what we have with standard chemotherapy. So while one could probably enrich the likelihood of response, that hasn't translated into an impact on clinical practice, because even in patients without expression, these treatments probably still represent better options than the treatments that we've had available before. The data from the randomized setting with the pembrolizumab trial is incredibly important, because it does show that the hazard ratio in terms of improvement in survival is even more impressive in the PD-L1 selected group. But in patients who were not selected, the all-comer population, there is still a significant improvement in survival, which appears to be clinically significant as well.
What was determined in terms of tolerability and toxicity issues in general? As you mentioned, checkpoint inhibitors alone have been relatively well tolerated. Any unusual toxicities that were observed in the bladder trials?
I can't say that there have been toxicities specific to the bladder cancer population that are unusual, but one of the aspects to these drugs that I think warrants a little bit of consideration is the fact that when results are presented from clinical trials, usually with toxicity data, what's reported are adverse events that occur in greater than or equal to 5% of the population. And I think we might be missing rare side effects that are only occurring in 1 to 2 patients. I think about this the same way you think about these rare genetic alterations. When you look at mutation data, there are rare mutated genes, which might be clinically important, but it's not really spoken about because it's hard to interpret. We don't know if those are meaningful. And I think similarly with some of this long tail in terms of adverse events, it's hard to sort out sometimes if it's drug-related or not. But I think we are missing a number of immune-related adverse events that are only occurring in a few patients.
Any in particular you have in mind or that you've observed?
I've really observed immune-related adverse events that mimic the spectrum of autoimmune diseases. So things like polymyalgia rheumatica are really classic signs for that and seem to temporarily be associated with starting immune checkpoint blockade, got better with steroid management. So these sorts of things.
It kind of ties into also the question, which I've been asking people for all different tumor types, and I don't know how often it occurs, which is people with prior autoimmune diseases. And I'm curious when you know about it, because, you know, like polymyalgia rheumatica, I mean, maybe they had it and never realized it. You know, I don't know. But do you have any patients who've had Crohn's disease or other autoimmune diseases? And how did you deal with it in that situation?
I think it's a great point in terms of whether or not some of these were subclinical prior to initiation of these treatments. Because the vast majority of clinical trials have excluded patients with these conditions, the experience is obviously quite limited. I have not had experience treating patients with inflammatory bowel disease yet. I would say that the frequency of some of these diagnoses, inflammatory bowel disease, even psoriasis, is markedly higher than I would have predicted before looking for these diagnoses with the availability of these drugs. So I think ultimately we will have to better understand what's happening with treatment in these patients because these diagnoses are not so uncommon. I have treated patients with psoriasis. I have treated patients with rheumatoid arthritis. I've been lucky so far. There is some published data, of course, even though it's retrospective, with ipilimumab in patients with pre-existing autoimmune diseases showing that there does seem to be a flare in those diseases, but in most patients, you can get away with it with treating those flares. And so I think it's a work in progress.
What are some of the new trial concepts and new trials that are ongoing right now in checkpoint inhibitors that you think are most important for oncologists to know about?
So there are a number of trials in the adjuvant setting. We spoke about adjuvant therapy as really being an unmet need for a couple of reasons. One, because the data has been a little bit less compelling than in the neoadjuvant setting, although probably for a number of clinical trial-related reasons. The other is because a large proportion of our patients can't receive cisplatin-based chemotherapy because of renal function or other comorbidities. And so there are at least 3 trials, randomized phase 3 trials, exploring adjuvant immune checkpoint blockade in patients with bladder cancer. One exploring nivolumab, one exploring atezolizumab, and a cooperative group trial that will be up and running in the not-too-distant future exploring pembrolizumab. Importantly, all of these trials enroll patients who have either T3 disease or higher, or node-positive disease at the time of cystectomy, who are cisplatin ineligible or who refuse adjuvant chemotherapy, but also enroll patients who've had neoadjuvant chemotherapy and have residual disease in the bladder, T2 disease or higher. And that's really a major unmet need, that population. And so the results from these trials are, of course, eagerly awaited. The next set of very important trials are trials being done in the first-line treatment setting, the chemotherapy-naive first-line metastatic setting. And there are a number of phase 3 trials which are potentially practice-changing, which are going on in that space. There's a trial combining durvalumab with tremelimumab, a combination of PD-L1 blockade and CTLA-4 blockade, versus durvalumab alone, PD-L1 blockade alone, versus standard of care chemotherapy. There's a trial being done with atezolizumab, in cisplatin-ineligible patients with metastatic disease, randomizing patients between gemcitabine and carboplatin with placebo versus gemcitabine and carboplatin with atezolizumab. So these trials asking really different questions have the potential to change how we treat patients in a dramatic way.
At this point, when you look at the various checkpoint inhibitors, from your point of view, does it seem like they're essentially equivalent, both in terms of efficacy and toxicity? There is the issue of the interval every 2 or 3 weeks. I don't know if you consider that a significant difference.
So as I look across the data that we have so far, I do think that these treatments look pretty similar, both in terms of safety and in terms of efficacy. There are some differences in the antibodies. There are some theoretical differences in mechanism of action. But really, when you look at the data, it looks quite similar. The schedule issue, I think, is an interesting one because I would think that a treatment that's administered less often would be favored by patients, or at least potentially. Although I've heard recently from a number of colleagues with patients telling them that they don't mind coming in more frequently. In fact, they feel more comfortable being seen, being under care with that frequency. They feel safer to some extent. So I think that we place some value judgments on that, but I'm not sure we actually know how all of our patients feel in that regard. Of course, there are some financial issues that need to be considered as well.
Durvalumab, is that every 2 or 3 weeks?
Durvalumab is every 4 weeks.
Oh, every 4 weeks. Huh, that's interesting. You know, to maybe finish out in terms of checkpoint inhibitors, we could talk about your other patient, the 62-year-old man. And I'm particularly interested in what happened when he actually received nivolumab because I see he had sort of some complications.
So this is a very interesting situation in that this patient had metastatic urothelial cancer involving both lymph nodes and involving a sacral mass and was having a lot of pain from the sacral mass and initiated treatment with nivolumab. And again, pretty soon after starting treatment, started to feel better, had less pain, and we really had a feeling even before repeating the first set of scans that he would be responding, and the scans certainly showed that. He continued on treatment and really was tolerating treatment quite well, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a side effect, but got about a year into treatment and then started to have diarrhea. And had diarrhea to the extent, and it occurred relatively suddenly, to the extent that he showed up in emergency room, was passing some blood at that time, had a CAT scan done, which did show thickening of the rectum, and ended up starting steroids the following day, and had rapid relief of his symptoms, and his steroids were very slowly tapered without a recurrence of those symptoms. Once his symptoms had resolved completely and he was off steroids, we repeated scans, of course, to see if things had progressed prior to considering restarting treatment, and he had not had progression of disease and by that time really had a near complete response, and he resumed treatment and continues on treatment without a recurrence of colitis to this day.
I'm sure the thought of maybe just holding off on therapy at that point when he was in CR came into your mind. How did you make the determination to restart treatment? It sounds like a little bit scary.
Yes, so this was really based on a discussion with the patient. He's a younger guy. I had such a good experience with treatment initially that, quite understandably so, he was hesitant to compromise the response and the durability of the response. And so we had discussed upon reinitiating treatment that it would be possible that these symptoms of colitis would recur. And if that happened, then proceeding with additional treatment would really probably be unsafe. And so a shared decision like occurs in most of these situations.
Any data on what the likelihood is to develop, you know, colitis again on retreatment?
I don't know the numbers, to be honest, but I do know that anecdotally, I've heard from a number of people that have had immune-related side effects treated with steroids that resolve without recurrence upon reinitiation of treatment. And in fact, most of the treatment algorithms for immune-related side effects do allow for this, provided that the severity of the initial side effects was not too great where the risk would really be unacceptable.
Anything particularly diagnostic about this colitis, and how do you rule out it being from another cause?
very difficult to do so. And part of it has to do with the temporal relationship between treatment and initiation of the symptoms. We do the normal things in terms of making sure there's no C. diff if there are risk factors for that. Stool cultures. Some patients I have had get colonoscopy when I was really not sure and the pattern of symptoms really seemed to be unusual. But in most cases, it's not that subtle and really occurs sort of out of nowhere.
I see that he had an asymptomatic increase in amylase lipase that I guess resolved. How often do you see that? And do you ever see clinically significant pancreatitis?
So this is apparently more frequent than I had realized. After he developed it, we started to look at how many other patients had elevation, and his elevation was higher than a lot of patients, but it is not uncommon for this to occur. It's incredibly unusual to have symptomatic pancreatitis, and the vast majority of these episodes are asymptomatic laboratory elevations. What was unusual in his situation, of course, was that it occurred after treatment had been held and he was already on steroids for colitis. So that pattern was unusual, but this is not an uncommon event. And I think most of the time we don't check amylase and lipase in clinical practice, and so it probably occurs a lot more than we realize.
I'm trying to remember if it's with checkpoint inhibitors that people were observed diabetes with the pancreas getting wiped out.
Yes, that is true.
Can you talk a little bit about what, because, you know, for all the times we've talked about checkpoint inhibitors, I never heard anybody bring this up till last week. And I was like, really? What do we know about that?
So with combination CTLA-4 blockade and PD-1, PD-L1 blockade, I think it's possible that some of these lower frequency immune-related events that I was referring to become higher frequency, and so they're being recognized. And I think one example of that is immune-related diabetes. And so this is something that we certainly see from time to time with single-agent therapy, but is more frequent with combination therapy. And then, of course, another example of this is myocarditis and cardiac-related side effects as highlighted in a recent New England Journal paper.
That's interesting. So cardiomyopathy?
Myocarditis, actually. More of an inflammatory insult to the myocardium.
But with what? Heart failure? Or?
Manifested as arrhythmias, heart failure.
Huh. Wow. Interesting. What about TKIs, those that are being used right now in other diseases? And one that I've heard about is cabozantinib.
So targeting VEGF receptor and other kinases with multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitors that inhibit VEGFR and other kinases as well has been explored in bladder cancer over the past decade. So there have been trials with sunitinib and trials with pazopanib. Both of those trials have shown objective responses in a very small percentage of patients, but do establish some proof of concept that it's probably possible to elicit a response to single agent therapy with these drugs. And so that has led to some interest in testing some of these newer generation multi-targeted kinase inhibitors, including cabozantinib. So there's a trial of cabozantinib as a single agent at the National Cancer Institute, which has been presented in preliminary form and shows an objective response rate in about the 20 to 30% range with these therapies. That has led to a couple of approaches, but probably one of the most interesting approaches based on some evidence showing immune modulation with cabozantinib in urothelial cancer patients has been to combine cabozantinib with nivolumab or with nivolumab and ipilimumab. And that's a study that's ongoing that's being led by the NCI.
I kind of knew what the next part of that sentence was because I've heard that with other tumors. And I've heard even bevacizumab as potentially having an immunologic, you know, sort of basis. And for that matter, has bevacizumab been looked at in bladder cancer? And any thoughts about why there might be synergy between VEGF and checkpoint inhibitors?
The bevacizumab story so far is based on some suggestion that T cells can infiltrate the tumor better with VEGF inhibition, and that's been pretty nicely shown in kidney cancer with post-treatment biopsies in patients receiving combination VEGF inhibition plus PD-L1 inhibition showing a higher frequency of T cell infiltration than compared to single-agent PD-L1 inhibition. Now, those are very small numbers, but really do establish some proof of concept based on what was anticipated to happen based on data in model systems. That hasn't been studied yet in bladder cancer. However, there is an upcoming study that will be managed through the Hoosier Cancer Research Network in cisplatin-ineligible patients, randomizing patients to atezolizumab alone versus atezolizumab plus bevacizumab.
In terms of TKIs, have you yourself administered any of these VEGF TKIs to patients with bladder cancer on a trial?
So sunitinib and sunitinib on trial and pazopanib on a few patients off trial before we had some of these newer treatments available.
Any objective responses or useful responses?
I haven't seen objective responses myself. I have seen some patients with stable disease for whom it's, of course, difficult to know how much impact the treatment had. What I should point out is that there are some data from Monty Paul at City of Hope showing the use of pazopanib in patients with FGFR3 mutant bladder cancer, given that one of the kinases that pazopanib targets, although not at very high potency, is FGFR.
Are there situations where you would consider giving one of these TKIs? You mentioned some pretty encouraging data with cabozantinib, for example, outside a trial setting.
Of course, with more and more treatments available in this disease and more trials available, that's really become a less common scenario where I'm facing that decision. In the past, a number of trials available for patients with metastatic urothelial cancer has been incredibly small, and we were really looking for anything that might have an inkling of benefit for our patients. And now there's just a huge number of clinical trials, and in fact, probably as many clinical trial slots as there are patients. So, of course, that's always the first consideration. But given that these drugs are available and there is some compelling data for the right patient, it could be a consideration.
And kind of in that same vein, the final question, which is the issue that comes up in a lot of cancers now. You have a patient who's going through chemotherapy, they've gone through checkpoint inhibitors, they've gotten the approved therapy, they're still in good shape. You know, there isn't a trial available for them. What about multiplex testing, next generation sequencing? From a practical point of view, is that something a doc in the general oncology setting should consider?
So I think it's something to consider, and I will point out that there is an endorsement of that strategy from the NCCN bladder cancer group. There's been a publication highlighting that in the JCO. The reason that that is an endorsement is because there are a number of potential alterations that could theoretically be actionable, as I mentioned. And so I think it's a reasonable strategy. We still don't know the ultimate benefit of doing this for our patients, of course, and I think it's going to be some time before we have enough trials that pair genetic alterations or genomic alterations with treatments to know if we're really doing the right thing with multiplex testing versus testing for a single alteration. But I don't think it's unreasonable. One of the alterations that we didn't touch on, which really started the extreme responder sort of field, was a bladder cancer patient who had an extreme response to an mTOR inhibitor and in retrospect had activating mutations, which would confer sensitivity to mTOR inhibition. And so this is not an unreasonable strategy, and there are accumulating anecdotes to be able to potentially make sense of that data and pair that data to treatments directed at HER2, mTOR inhibitors, the potential to find a trial with an FGFR3 inhibitor if there is an FGFR3 mutation. So certainly potential ways to act on that information, and I think ultimately that the evidence will catch up with the clinical practice.